was almost certainly unnecessary, but as a surgeon with only minimal knowledge of anaesthesia, I was in no position to argue. I told my juniors to beg the cardiac staff to get the test done first thing the next morning. Instead of operating, I had therefore spent much of the day dozing angrily on the sofa in the surgeon's sitting room, watching the dull sky through the high, viewless windows, waiting for the test to be done. The occasional pigeon flew past, and sometimes I could see airliners in the distance, nosing their way through the low clouds towards Heathrow. The test, despite my junior's pleas, was not done until 4 in the afternoon. Since the operation might well take several hours, and I am only supposed to operate on emergencies out of hours, I had to explain to the distressed and tearful patient, when she finally arrived outside the operating theatres in a wheelchair with an angry daughter, that I would have to cancel the operation. I promised to put her first on my next list, so she was wheeled back to the ward, and I bicycled home in a bad temper. Adding her to my next list would very probably mean having to cancel some of the other operations already planned for the day. After I had discussed her case with the junior doctors at the Monday morning meeting, I went to the reception desk outside the operating theatres. The anaesthetist, a different one from the one who had ordered the echocardiogram, was standing there with my registrar, Mike, who looked gloomily at me. Mrs. Seagrave's growing MRSA on the swabs, which were taken when she was admitted last week and her operation was cancelled, Mike said. The theatre will have to have a one-hour clean after her operation. We won't be able to get the list done if we do her first, so I rearranged the list so that she's at the end of the list. Well, I suppose we'll have to break my promise to her that we'd do her first, I replied. It doesn't make much sense, though, does it? They test her for MRSA the day before the operation and don't get the results back for several days. If we had operated as planned last week, we wouldn't have done a one-hour clean, would we? Mrs. Seagrave's daughter was threatening to sue us last night, he said. She said we were all hopelessly disorganized. I'm afraid she's right, but suing us isn't going to help, is it? No, he replied. It just puts one's back up and it's quite upsetting. Why the fuss? The anaesthetist turned up and said she'd have to be cancelled. Oh, for Christ's sake, why? I exploded. Because she's been put at the end of the list and therefore we won't finish before 5 o'clock. Which bloody anaesthetist? I don't know. A slim blonde. I think she's the new locum. I walked the few feet to the anaesthetic room and put my head through the door. The anaesthetist, Rachel, and her junior were leaning against the side of the worktop lining the wall of the anaesthetic room, drinking coffee from polystyrene cups, waiting for the first patient to arrive. "What's all this about cancelling the last case?" I asked. The anaesthetist was indeed a new one, a locum recently appointed to replace my regular anaesthetist who was on maternity leave. We had done a few lists together, and she had seemed competent and pleasant. "I'm not starting a big meningioma at 4 p.m., she declared, turning towards me. "I've got no childcare this evening." "But we can't cancel it," I protested. "She was cancelled once already." "Well, I'm not doing it." "You have to ask your colleagues then," I said. "I don't think they will. It's not an emergency," she replied in a slow and final tone of voice. For a few moments I was struck dumb. I thought of how until a few years ago a problem like this would never have arisen. I always try to finish the list at a reasonable time, but in the past everybody accepted that sometimes the list would have to run late. In the pre-modern NHS, consultants never counted their hours. You just went on working until the work was done. I felt an almost overwhelming urge to play the part of a furious, raging surgeon and wanted to roar out as I would have done in the past. "Bugger childcare! You'll never work with me again!" But it would have been an empty threat, since I have little say in who anaesthetizes my patients. Besides, surgeons can no longer get away with such behaviour. I envy the way in which the generation who trained me could relieve the intense stress of their work by losing their temper, at times quite outrageously, without fear of being had up for bullying and harassment. I spun on my heel and walked down the corridor trying to work out how to solve the problem. The solution appeared immediately in the form of Julia, the bed manager, who was coming down the theatre corridor looking for me. "We've admitted the two routine spines to the day room for your list today, but we haven't got any beds to put them in afterwards. There were so many emergency admissions last night. What do you want to do?" she asked, looking strained. She was clutching her diary with its long list of patients who needed to be admitted, discharged or transferred, and the phone numbers of the bed managers in other hospitals who would probably be equally stressed and would be reluctant to accept them because they were also short of beds. "If we haven't got any beds to put them in after the operation," I said, inwardly rejoicing, as this meant Mrs. Seagrave's operation would now start early enough to mean I might finish by 5 o'clock, "I can't very well operate, can I? You'll have to send them home. At least, they're fairly minor ops." So the operating list was now sufficiently truncated. 2 patients, starved from midnight in preparation for their frightening operations, would be given a cup of tea in consolation and sent home. I reluctantly walked to the day room on the ward where the patients to be operated upon that day were waiting. Since the hospital is chronically short of beds, more and more patients are brought in for surgery on the morning of their operation. This is standard practice in private hospitals and works very nicely, since there will be a room and bed into which each patient can be put. In an overstretched hospital like mine, however, this is not the case. So, when I entered the small day room, I found 15 patients, all awaiting major surgery, all squeezed into a room the size of a small kitchen, still wearing their coats, wet with the February rain, which steamed in the cramped conditions. Mike was on his knees in front of the patient who would be first on the list, since Mrs. Seagrave's operation would now have to be done in the afternoon. He was explaining the consent form to him. He has a rather loud voice, so all the other patients must have heard what he was saying. "I have to warn you, there are some risks to the operation. These include death, a major stroke, major hemorrhage or serious infection. Just sign here, please." He handed the consent form, a document that has become so complicated of late that it even has a table of contents on its front cover, to the patient with a pen, and the man quickly scribbled his signature without looking at it. I apologised to the 2 women whose spinal operations had been cancelled. I explained that there had been several emergency admissions during the night, and they politely nodded their understanding, though I could see that one of them had been crying. "We'll try to bring you back as soon as possible," I said, "but I'm afraid that at the moment I don't know when that will be." I dislike telling patients that their operation has been cancelled at the last moment, just as much as I dislike telling people that they have cancer and are going to die. I resent having to say sorry for something that is not my fault, and yet the poor patients cannot very well be sent away without somebody saying something. I spoke briefly to the man with facial pain, whose case I would do first, and then to Mrs. Seagrave, who was waiting in a corner with her daughter beside her. "I'm so sorry about last week," I said, "and I'm sorry that I can't do your operation first, but I promised to get it done this afternoon." They looked a little dubiously at me. "Well, let's hope so," said her daughter with a grim expression. I turned to face all the patients crammed into the little room. "I'm sorry about all this," I said to them, waving my arm round the crowded room, "but we're a bit short of beds at the moment." As I said this, suppressing the urge to deliver a diatribe about the government and hospital management, I wondered once again at the way in which patients in this country so rarely complain. Mike and I left for the theatres. "Do you think I've said sorry enough?" I asked him. "Yes," he replied.